And we appreciate that. I love it when our young people are involved in the music program. That's always a great blessing. I want to make mention, if I could, about Tim Cleghorn when he gives testimony about how the Lord has led him and his wife in regard to their ministry. I'm not going to give any of this away. Of course, Tim is a member of our church, and he joined after he joined the Worldview Ministries team. This past June, I was at the team meeting for Worldview Ministries, and Tim gave detailed, really stories, I guess, a detailed testimony about his working in the part of the world where he works. And if you ever heard of the book The Lone Survivor or the movie The Lone Survivor, that area, that mountainous area where a bunch of mountains and countries come together in a very difficult and desperate area, that is where he works. So that is where the Navy forces, special forces, had to go in and deal with the terrorist operation, and much of that went bad, if you're familiar with the book or the movie. When I heard his testimony on that evening in June, when he gave his testimony, I was dumbstruck with what that young family had done, going into a very closed area, sticking out like a sore thumb. I'm not going to give all the details. And after he was done, I was so astounded by what they had done. Because, you know, you think of missionaries, oh, they're going to be a missionary, oh, they're going over to China. Okay, well, they're going to have chow mein and read fortune cookies, and that's what it's going to be. May I tell you something? Nothing could be further from the truth. What is so astounding that Americans would go into such a difficult and closed area. I'm not going to tell his testimony, but I'm going to say you've got to hear that testimony. He's going to tell it in detail. I said to him afterwards, I said, I want you to tell our church, bring us to that place. Tell us how it is to arrive in a place like that, being the only Americans, the only white people in the whole area, sticking out like a sore thumb. He's going to tell all the details, and you will be astounded. By the way, he will rise in your Parthenon, your mental Parthenon of heroes. He will arise to a very high level when you understand the sacrifice and, frankly, the danger of getting the gospel into a very closed place. You say, well, Pastor Mahdi, you know, this is the age of the internet, so much of the world is opening again for the gospel. Quite the contrary. A couple weeks ago, the president of China, and I won't even attempt to pronounce his name, but I think Ping or Qing is in there somewhere, but the president of China gave a 3.5-hour speech. Can you imagine that? You thought my sermons were long. He gave a 3.5-hour speech to the meeting of the communist elite. And in that speech, he said this. He said, they're turning back the clock in China. He said, we're going to more strictly follow the teachings of Marx and of their the communism that they were founded by. He said, we're going to control every aspect of the people's lives, especially their religious belief. And we know that our missionaries, the Lalmans, were recently expelled from Beijing, about, I guess, a little more than a year ago, expelled from Beijing, and that pressure is going to continue. So when someone says, well, China's an advancing Western, in their Western ideals, they are not. They are, by statement, they are reverting. This president has served, is in his second 5-year term. It is traditional after 10 years of service as the Chinese president that you would step down from that position. He has indicated that he's not going to keep that tradition, that he will break with tradition. And a major American publication referred to this man, because he holds almost dictatorial power over 1.3 billion people, recently an American publication, I think it was The Economist, referred to him as, quote, the most powerful man in the world. Now, that's shocking when you consider that normally our president is referred to as that, and so we have much to pray about, but there's much missionary work to do. Take your Bible, turn to Philippians chapter 4 with me. Philippians chapter 4. I'm going to do something tonight. This will be part of my Peace of Mind series. We're going to read verse 9. We covered that last time. We're finishing through the book of Philippians. We've been in this for several months now. But we've been emphasizing the matter of the peace of mind. How to have peace of mind. I've tried to be very systematic. This past Sunday night, I began a review of some of the major principles. The Sunday after this, I will continue with that review to get the major principles into your mind. Because so many of you have come up to me and said that by practicing these things, it is actually changing your emotional life. It is really, really helping you. I said I've not preached a series of messages that I feel has had more impact in our church and in listenership around the world and people who watch us on live stream than this series. And so I'm continuing that tonight, but what's interesting about the passage tonight is this. Paul is going to give us an actual illustration of how these principles worked in his own life in a particular situation that many of us would have probably gone a little bit cuckoo over, if I may, or at least been depressed or anxious about. So look at verse number 9, Philippians 4, verse 9, as a starting point. Paul says, "Those things which ye have both learned and received and heard and seen in me do." Now, we're about to see something in Paul. He's about to give us a little insight into his own life. "The things you've learned, received, heard, and seen in me do, and the God of peace shall be with you." I want you to notice that. There's a promise of God's peace when you practice these things. Now, listen carefully. Someone said, "Pastor Monty, the messages changed my life." Well, I would be more accurate and tell you if your life has changed in a positive way, it's not just that I preached a sermon, but that it's you actually did what I told you to do. Okay, that's the key. It's very easy to leave an auditorium and say, "Oh, Pastor Monty, that was a great sermon." But if you don't do what is said in the sermon, then you don't get the impact of the truth. And so I'm encouraging you to do these things. Now, then Paul gives a part of a little story, and we're going to elaborate on it somewhat tonight. Verse number 10, Paul says this, "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at the last your care of me hath flourished again, wherein ye were also careful, but ye lacked opportunity." What is he referring to? Paul had virtually no contact with the church at Philippi for 10 years at the writing of this letter. Paul was in prison, and there's different opinions as to where he was in prison, but he wrote this letter from prison. He wrote this letter while he was shackled to a Roman guard and likely was confined to a very small space with only a few visitors allowed to see him. He wrote this letter that's the theme of the letter, of course, is joy and how to have joy in one's life. He wrote this letter under those circumstances, but he also writes to the church at Philippi. He said, "It's been 10 years since I've heard from you." He said, "I'm rejoicing now because your care for me has flourished again." Well, what had they done? They had sent, pardon me, by the hand of Epaphroditus, they had sent an offering to the Apostle Paul. Now, I want you to think with me for a moment. For 10 years, Paul has heard virtually nothing directly from this church. People that he loved, people that he'd given his heart to, for 10 years, he heard virtually nothing. Everyone look this way. What if you had given your heart to something, and then for 10 years you heard nothing from them? What would you think? What would you think? You might think, "Wow, they must be mad at me." Or you might think, "Well, you know, I feel kind of sorry for myself. After all, I'd given myself in service and ministry to them, and now I haven't heard a word from them in 10 years. The average person in this room, if you had a relationship with someone, and then all of a sudden it seemed like it got cut off, and I understand this was not a time of the internet and cell phones, and that communication was difficult, but the average person in this room, if you had a relationship with someone, and then all of a sudden you just didn't hear from them for the next 10 years, your mind would turn over many, many times. Either worry, concern for them, what has happened. Paul might have thought maybe the church is failing. Maybe there's a struggle or a problem. He could only hear rumors. He'd not heard anything that was direct. But verse number 10, he says, he talks about an offering they'd given. By the way, don't you think he was relieved? I think he certainly was. But know what he says concerning this offering, okay? He says several things. He says, "Your care of me," verse 10, "hath flourished again. Wherein you were also careful, but you lacked opportunity." I'll speak to that in a moment. But then he says this in verse number 11, and I think this is fascinating because this gives us a window on the thinking of the Apostle Paul, how he's applied the principles that I've systematically taught over the weeks. It gives us a window. Verse number 11, "Not that I speak in respect of want." Paul's saying, listen, I'm thankful for the offering, but I want you to know I have not been in a state of want. In other words, I have not been in a state of desire for an offering. And what's the rationale for this? Verse 11, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. Paul was saying, I'm glad to have contact with you. I'm very thankful for the offering. But he said, my contentment is not based upon the offering. And then he elaborates that in verse number 12. He says, I know both how to be abased and how to abound. I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things, I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. For 10 years, he hasn't heard of them. Finally, they send him an offering. And he's saying, I'm very thankful for the offering. But he also says this. He says, I want you to know that during the time that I did not have your offering, I did not suffer want. It is not the idea that Paul didn't have needs, because every one of us has material needs. We have to put food in our stomachs and clothes on our backs. But Paul is saying, my mentality, listen carefully, my mentality was not one of suffering deprivation. Even though I may not have had everything that your latest offering can afford for me. So what are we saying? I'm essentially saying this. Paul is giving us a great example of how to practice the mental discipline that we've been teaching. How did Paul practice this discipline? Okay, he gives the example. Hadn't heard from them in 10 years. Finally, they sent an offering. Paul cautions them to say, listen, I'm not speaking in respect of want. How did Paul have that spirit that whether he had all those needs met or not, he didn't feel like he was in want? Well, I'm going to give you some of the ideas. Verse number 10. Look, if you will, there. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that your care of me hath flourished again. He said, I was excited when I heard from you. I was excited about the offering. But note the words, I rejoiced in the Lord. His chief concern was to rejoice in what God was doing, not so much what man was doing. In other words, he had a right response to positive circumstances. Now look, everyone, here's something that I've emphasized. When something positive happens, it is appropriate to rejoice in that. Someone who has a wrong view of the philosophy of Stoicism would say, well, Pastor Monty, no matter what happens, positive or negative, I'm just going to be like a stone in response to everything. That is never the teaching of the Bible. When something good happens, Paul had a positive response. He rejoiced in regard to that. In other words, in that moment that that offering came, that word from that church that he had not heard from in 10 years, Paul says, wow, this is fantastic. In this moment, something good has happened. I want you to notice this. He did not make it negative. Preacher, what are you talking about? Some of us in this room, myself included, have the habit of turning even a positive thing into a negative. Think with Paul. Paul had not heard from these people in 10 years. All of a sudden, they sent him an offering. Paul said, wow, that's wonderful. And some of us, if we were in Paul's shoes, would read into it, and we would say, huh, they sent me an offering. I wonder what they're after now. Do you know what I'm saying by that? Well, so-and-so, I haven't heard from so-and-so in 10 years. They sent me this letter, or they sent me a voicemail and said, call them. I wonder what they want. That's taking something positive, reading a negative motive into it, and turning it right around. Paul doesn't do that. You have a friend. You haven't heard from this friend in 10 years. All of a sudden, they call you, and they're like, hey, be sure to give me a call back. I've got an opportunity from you. And what goes through your mind? Not that they want to renew the friendship, but that they joined Amway. That's what goes through your mind. They're part of a multi-level marketing scheme. Paul didn't ruin the joy of that offering by making a negative assumption. He also didn't do this. When Paul received that offering from that church, and I'm sure a little note or something of encouragement to him, Paul didn't look at that and say, well, 10 years have passed. It's about time. Not a hint of that. He rejoiced in the Lord. Isn't it phenomenal how sometimes we can turn even a good occurrence into something that is negative? He didn't even think about their possible negligence. He simply rejoiced in the Lord. Now notice this. His focus in rejoicing was right. It was in the Lord. Do you know why? Paul saw every circumstance, whether you categorize it as good or bad, and I'll speak to that in a moment. Paul saw every circumstance as coming from God. So in something positive like an offering, and no one can deny the positive nature of an offering, when something positive like that came, he viewed it as coming from God, that God had used the Philippian church, that God should get the glory, that God had moved upon their heart in a positive way. He viewed the positive circumstances as God's grace. He had a right focus in his rejoicing. The same, by the way, should be true in the negative things, what we call negative, that come our way. But he also had a right attitude toward the timing of it. Notice this. He says this in verse number 10, "Your care of me hath flourished again. Your care of me hath flourished again, wherein ye were also careful, but ye lacked opportunity." What is he saying? The timing was just right. He says this, "Listen, I've survived these 10 years. It's been wonderful. Way back in the past, you'd given me an offering way back then. Haven't heard from you in 10 years. And now right at the right exact moment, isn't God good?" By the way, God often does that to us. Sometimes the answer comes at exactly the right moment. I don't know if I've shared this recently, but I remember one time as a young preacher, my I think it was an auto insurance bill was due. It sort of pops up when you least expect it, the big old auto insurance bill. I didn't have the money for it, all the money I needed. I lacked $100. And I remember seeing the bill and I thought, well, where am I going to get $100? My salary at that time was $75 a week. I was a single guy. I had sat down to eat my Totino's pizza, my frozen Totino's pizza that I had made for myself and put lots of pepper on because it's more palatable that way. I sat down to eat that. I had that bill sitting on the table. As I bowed my head by myself, Lord, I need $100. I don't know where I'm going to get it. Lord, please supply $100. Bless the Totino's pizza. Help me not to get sick. In Jesus' name, amen. Before I was done with the pizza, and you say, Pastor Monty, did you really eat a whole pizza? Well, it's one of those ones about this big. But yes, I ate the whole thing. And yes, I was still hungry when I was done. Before I had eaten the whole pizza, there was a knock on the back door, and I got up and walked over and opened the door. It was one of my deacons, and he said this. He said, Pastor, he said, my wife and I were just sitting down to supper, and he said, as we were praying for you, he said, the Lord told me that you need $100. And he said, here is $100. Right in the nick of time. Now, I'll tell you, God does that. It's God and his timing. By the way, if I had never had the need, I would never have seen the grace of God manifest or the power of prayer manifest in such a definite way. So he had a right attitude toward the timing. He rejoiced in the Lord. But notice the last part of verse number 10, because I really think this is interesting. What was his attitude? These people hadn't spoken to him in 10 years. Notice this, wherein ye were also careful. Speaking of this offering, speaking of the past, he said, you were careful. In other words, you still had care for me. Now, Paul is assuming this. Listen carefully. Wherein ye were also careful, but ye lacked opportunity. Do you know what he did? Not only did he rejoice in the Lord, but number two, he gave the benefit of the doubt. Now you listen to me. A lot of our problems stem from not giving people the benefit of the doubt. Well, Pastor Monty, I know so-and-so is just really upset with me because of the way they you should have seen the look they gave me. Stop. That's crazy talk. You don't know unless they walked up to you, grabbed you by the shirt collar, pulled you right nose to nose and said, I'm mad at you. Okay, then that's good evidence that they really are. But if someone gives you, quote unquote, a dirty look, and you just assume that, you become anxious because you think there's damage to relationship where there is none. Maybe they didn't feel good. Maybe they were in a hurry. Maybe they had had a bad day. But you know what we need to do is give people the benefit of the doubt. Here, Paul had not spoken to these people. They had not communicated with him in 10 years. But he believed, Paul said, he believed that their hearts were still for him. Their hearts were in the right place. Look what he said. He said, you were also careful. In other words, he said, I know during this time you were caring for me. I know you've been praying for me, but you just lacked opportunity. Do you see that? Isn't that generous? After 10 years, well, Pastor Monty, you know, that just sounds like kind of a Pollyannish way to view things. Why not view them that way rather than thinking immediately of the most negative thought you can possibly think and be dead wrong? I'd rather go through life believing that people like me and are praying for me than to go through life bitter and angry because something I had invested in has now gone away. And you do have a choice in that matter. He gave them the benefit of the doubt. But notice this in verse number 10. He said, you were careful. In other words, you still cared for me. He said, during that time when I hadn't heard from you, he said, I know you still cared for me. But look at verse 10. But you lacked opportunity. Paul said this, during that time of not hearing from you, I just assumed that, hey, the only reason I haven't heard from them, they still care for me, they still love me, but they just circumstances got in the way. They lacked opportunity. There's some logical reason. Now, do you know what this is? This is Paul, under divine inspiration, stating that he had given the Philippian church the benefit of the doubt. And right away, somebody said, ah, Pastor Monty, that's just Paul using flowery speech to ingratiate himself. No. Do you know why? No, that's not the case. Because these words are given under divine inspiration of the Scripture. This is not Paul pretending he had a positive attitude. This is Paul genuinely having a positive attitude in a set of circumstances that could have assumed some level of negativity. In other words, he said it was circumstances, not their apathy, that had kept their generosity at bay. You know what, folks? One of the most destructive attitudes you can ever adopt in life is this. No one cares about me. That simply isn't true. People do care. People do care if you have a heartache or a burden. People you would not imagine care for you. When I went through that difficulty in February with the loss of my brother, what amazed me, what astounded me, were phone calls, cards and letters, not only by the hundreds from this church, but from people across the country that I had not heard of in years. What astounded me was the renewed friendships. Let me just make a statement here. When you adopt this, well, no one really cares about me, that is a pity party. And it is simply not true and should never be true among people who are believers. In other words, Paul did not assign dark motives to the what we would assume to be the failure of someone else. Paul didn't say they don't care. Paul said, but they had something insurmountable that prohibited them. They lacked opportunity. There was that kind of problem. And when you think wrongly that way, it can ruin relationships. And that's what we've talked about over and over again in this series, about how people wrongly read into everything. Well, you know, so-and-so hasn't called me this week. I guess they don't like me anymore. That's horrible, horrible thinking. I have a pastor friend that we talk every once in a while, I suppose every few weeks, every once a month maybe, something like that. And he's very fundamental. I'm very fundamental, but he's very fundamental. I'm very fundamental too, but he's like ultra fundamental. And so if I don't hear from him, I always call him up. If I don't hear from him after a while, I always call him up and I call him and I say, hey, Brother so-and-so, haven't heard from you for a while. I was wondering if you separated from me, okay? Separated, you know. And he laughs. He says, no. He says, Brother Monty, I'd never separate from you, even though you are a liberal. By the way, isn't that crazy that someone would call me a liberal? You know that guy's a nutcase, okay? he's so far to the right, he fell off the edge of the earth. But we joke and we kid about that. I'm never serious about that. I kid with him about it. But how many times in life do we make these assumptions that aren't real? We build them up in our minds, and then all of a sudden we discover nothing could be further from the truth. I'm simply suggesting that we should give the benefit of the doubt. Even in negative circumstances. Well, Pastor Manio, what if somebody's just really grumpy and they're clearly agitated with me? Well, what about that? Okay. Listen to this. Wouldn't it be better, even in verifiably negative circumstances, to be able to say, huh, he must be having a really hard day. He didn't really mean that. Wouldn't that be better? Now, you know why I'm suggesting that? Because too many of us, myself included, have worn our feelings on our shirt sleeves. And we don't know what the other person is going through. And so someone was short with us, or somebody was maybe what we would consider rude. And we're really, really super sensitive to that about that today. We're sensitive about everything today. May I just suggest that you stop it and grow up? How many, all the news, news stories about Halloween were about costumes that offended people. What? Get over it. Okay, just stop and grow up. That was just a commercial. But wouldn't it be better if we recognized that sometimes people do have a hard day, that sometimes people say things that come out wrongly, pardon me. Haven't you done that before? Haven't you, I have done this before, haven't you in a moment of pressure said words that you wish you could snatch back out of the air and you regret having said them? Wouldn't you like it if the recipient of those words were to say, you know, I know he really doesn't feel that way. He was just having a hard day. Paul does this with the Philippian church. He clearly gives them the benefit of the doubt, and he's doing this as an example. He's giving us an example of how his thinking works so as not to build anxiety in his own life. Number three, look at this, if you will, verse number 11. I love this. He says, not that I speak in respect of want. I don't want you to think that I was starving to death. I don't want you to think that I was suffering. Not that I speak in respect of want. And now he explains it in verse number 11. For I have learned, it's a learned thing, in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. He did not speak in respect of want because, number three, he knew how to mute or to silence his desires. Boy, that's important. That's important. Remember at the beginning of my lesson series, way back whenever I started on this, I talked about the fact that unfulfilled desire creates anxiety. When people ruminate in their mind, they think over and over again about unfulfilled desire. It creates an anxiety for something. We had a word, we called it hedonic adaptation. I'm not going to go through that again. What is desire? Desire is something that we hope for. We either hope for something, we hope for something more, we hope for something better, or we hope for something different. And this could involve people, this could involve things, this could involve circumstances. People like this, oh, Pastor Monty, I just wish I weren't in thus and such circumstance. Paul said, I don't speak in respect of want. Now, were there times when he had legitimate needs that weren't completely fulfilled? Yes, because he said, I know how to be abased. That means essentially how to be brought down to nothing. He knew those things were real, but he said, I'm not allowing those things to affect me. Unfulfilled desire brings anxiety because fulfillment is often beyond our control. And Paul said this, I'm not talking to you in respect of want, that I was in a place where I really, really wanted an offering. He said that because he didn't think of himself that way. Paul had learned to stop wanting, to stop desiring, and to accept the present moment as it is. Now, listen to what I'm about to say. This is very, very key. Some of us need to silence the wishing part. Some of us need to silence the desire part. Some of us need to, well, Pastor Monty, you know, everything in my life would be great if only blah, blah, blah. Stop. If that's not within your control, you're creating for yourself needless anxiety, pointless anxiety, because it is outside of your control. Sometimes as a way to get people to talk when I'm doing marriage counseling, sometimes I will say this to the couple sitting in front of me. I'll say to the lady, I'll say, I'm going to ask you something. I'm going to say, what if I had a magic wand? And what if I could change anything, just one thing, not 10 things, not 20 things, not 1,000 things. What if I could change just one thing about your husband? I say, I want you to think, what would that be? And then I say to the husband, what if I could change just one thing, not 10, 20, or 1,000, one thing about your wife? What would that be? This is to get the conversation started. And they both think of something, and then I'll ask the wife what it is, ladies first, and then I'll ask the husband what it is that he would change. And by the way, it either produces an extremely valuable conversation or a fight. And I've had both. Fights are way more interesting to a pastor, but I've had both. I've had both in front of me. But Paul says here, I've learned to silence my desire. I'm not speaking in respect of want, because he wasn't thinking in respect of want. May I say a great problem we have in our society? The entitlement mentality magnifies desire and produces anxiety. The entitlement mentality magnifies, well, I have a right to this. Whoa, where is that in the Bible? Where is that in the Constitution? One of the biggest legal battles that we're facing in regard to the Obamacare legislation is the mandate concerning birth control. And the Trump administration has said religious organizations who oppose that don't need to provide that for people. And then you have people marching saying, women marching saying, the provision of free birth control is our right. And do you know what I say? You're crazier than a bedbug. That's insane. Nowhere does the Constitution guarantee that as right. Nowhere is that promised to you. There is not even a hint of that. But you know what all that whining comes from? It comes from entitlement mentality. And it comes from a desire to grab more from the government. And if the government gives something, boy, it's hard for people to let loose of it when we have to tighten our belts. And so it's a desire, it's an entitlement mentality. Paul said this, the Christian outlook is this, I have put aside my inordinate desires. The Bible uses the word covetousness. I have set those things aside, recognizing that they're damaging to me. I didn't sit here for the last 10 years, and part of that in Roman custody. I didn't sit here for the last 10 years and say, boy, I wish that Church of Philippi would send an offering. Boy, I wish they'd send an offering. Boy, I wish if they'd only send an offering. Boy, if they'd send an offering. He didn't do that. He said, guys, I'm thankful for the offering you gave me, but I didn't ruminate over the lack of it. It didn't affect me. Why? Verse number 12. The end of verse number 11. He said this, here's why. Here's the reason why. The word for indicates this is a reason. He says, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. What is Paul saying? I can practice contentment in every circumstance of life. You know, we think about contentment sometimes. We think about Thanksgiving dinner. My wife despises Thanksgiving dinner. She's a great cook, but she really throws herself at it, ladies. You know what I'm talking about. The get up early in the morning, the put the turkey in, the stuff the turkey with stuffing. Pastor Manning, you're not supposed to stuff a turkey with stuffing. You know, you can get botulism. Stop. Just stop. You're ruining everything, okay? Stuff the turkey with stuffing. By the way, the best stuffing recipe, ladies, tune in because Thanksgiving is just around the corner. The very best turkey stuffing recipe in the world is, and look it up online if you don't believe me, shredded White Castle hamburgers without the pickles. You have to remove the pickles and you have to add a couple things. White Castle stuffing is the best turkey stuffing you will ever have in your life. It beats oysters, which don't belong in a turkey anyway. It beats any kind of stuffing you'll ever have. We think Thanksgiving dinner. Kelly doesn't like it because here's what happens. She works on it for 12 hours. And we hit the table and devour the whole thing like a pack of wolves in 15 minutes and then troop down to watch TV. And she'll say something invariably through the meal. She'll say, why can't you people behave like human beings? Why can't you eat like a civilized person? And you know what we do? We slam it down so fast and our bellies get really full. And then we sit down and we're very content, aren't we? We're very content. We think of that as contentment. That's not contentment. Contentment is something that is learned, according to Paul. It is not natural. Being content in every state means in every set of circumstances, with all of it. No, if only this, that, or the other kind of thinking allowed. Being content means to be at peace with or at tranquility with my circumstances. I've suggested this to you in a previous lesson. I love this definition. Being content is wanting what I already have. That's contentment. Wanting what I already have. Oh, Pastor Monty, you know, I've got some stuff, but boy, I need the latest. No, contentment says I want what I already have. It also means to be indifferent about what you don't have. That's contentment. How does this come about? Let me give you some ideas quickly and I'll close. Paul said in verse 12, I know both how to be abased, how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry. I've been both places, both extremes, Paul says. Neither one of them matters to me, both to abound and to suffer need. What is he saying? He's saying essentially this: embrace all circumstances as they come. Okay, accept the things you cannot control. Church, look at me. If something is outside of your control, you need to accept it and embrace it as providentially allowed by God. And God is a good God, and God is a loving God. Well, Pastor Ron, I just can't accept that. Okay, you can spend the rest of your life mentally fighting against something that you cannot fix because it is outside of your control. And you will build anxiety and frustration. Rather than that, learn to embrace circumstances as they come. Learn from negatives. Learn coping mechanisms. Learn life lessons. Even negative things, embrace them as they come. And another idea is this: don't categorize good or bad. Look at verse 12. Paul says this: I know how to be abased, and that's very, very bad. Did you see that in there? No, it's not there. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Okay, I'm lower than a snake's belly, and I'm higher than a mountaintop. Everywhere in all things I'm instructed to be both full. That's very, very good. Does it say that? No, it doesn't. And to be hungry, that's very red. It doesn't say that either. It just says full and hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. You'll notice in this that in nowhere did Paul categorize these things as either good or bad. He didn't assign value to circumstances. He simply called them what they were, but he didn't assign a value. Why is that, preacher? Because in the big picture, Romans 8:28 says this, that God will work all things for good to those who love him, to those who are called according to his will, his glory. Follow me on this. There is a God in heaven who is working every set of circumstances for good. But Pastor Monty, I'm hungry. God used that in Paul's life. Pastor Monty, isn't it great? I'm abounding. I'm like on the mountaintop. Wonderful. Paul used that. God used that too in Paul's life, but he used both of those things. Don't categorize good or bad, because God ultimately knows the picture. Paul says, right now I'm hungry, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I gave my son a book that I'd been reading. I sent it to him. He's a voracious reader, my youngest son. I sent him this book, and he said, Dad, he said, I'm all excited. I said, what about, Matt? He said, I'm all excited about this book. What are you excited about? He said, I'm excited about my new eating plan. Well, the book wasn't actually about eating. I said, Matt, what do you mean? He said, well, he said in the book, he said, I read that if I don't eat until I'm actually hungry, I will enjoy food more. And I can eat simpler food, cheaper food, and enjoy food more, and save more money. So he said, I'm not going to touch any food until I'm really hungry. Then I'm going to buy something simple and just savor that simple thing. And he said, imagine the money I'll save. So any wonder he's not married yet, okay? That girl's going to suffer. She needs to. Toughen up. But my whole point being this, there's a truth to that. There really is a truth to that. If someone said, Pastor, one of my favorite meals is ham and beans. Do you like that? And when it's really good with some cornbread. How many like that? With a little cornbread? Oh, yeah, ham and beans and cornbread. It's one of my favorite things. Well, Pastor, come on, you know, it's not filet mignon. No. But when you're hungry, look at me. When you're hungry, I'm going to order me a filet mignon. Good luck, brother. That thing's the size of a silver dollar. Pathetic little scrap of meat. It doesn't equate to one mouthful for me. I'd be looking around saying, boy, I'm still hungry. But you give me a big old plate, big old bowl of ham and beans and a piece of cornbread, that'll stick right to your ribs, won't it? And you say, well, that's just simple food. When a person's hungry, they appreciate that kind of thing. I'm suggesting that we learn that what Paul said, to be satisfied, to not label things, to not label something as bad. Boy, I have other points. I'll share these with you later because we're running out of time. But here's my suggestion. This is going to go deep. It's not your circumstances that give you anxiety. It is your perception of them. And when you assign good and bad to everything and push God right out of the equation and forget about Romans 8:28, all of a sudden you're frustrated. But if you could step back for a second and say, all the good things of life and all the things I don't think are so good, they all come from God, listen, and they are all meant for my good. Follow what I'm about to say. At that moment, the anxiety goes away because every circumstance, regardless of how we would classify them, every circumstance comes from the hand of our good and benevolent God. I'm not troubled so much by a circumstance. I'm troubled by my perception. God is on his throne, and God is always good. Father, thank you for your word. So much more we can say here. I pray, Lord, that you'll bless us as we continue to discipline our thinking to match the scripture. Father, thank you for giving us so much detail in the Bible about this. I pray, Lord, now we will put into practice the things that we've heard. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.